handle the truth.
Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is March 1st in the year of our Lord, 2021, and it is 10:20 in the morning on the East Coast. Recording this a little earlier because I woke up at about 4:45 this morning and said, you know what, let's start forming my old-time habits of getting up and working out in the morning, and this will help shift my sleep patterns. If I just get out of bed now, read the paper, drink my coffee, start work early. No, I didn't work out, of course. I just watched John Oliver and slothed around, but I didn't go to sleep. So I will work out this afternoon. First day one of diet and lifestyle habits changing. Take 497 and click. But yeah, I just need to start waking up earlier, like start living life like I'm not a prisoner in my own home. So yeah, so we're doing this a little early. We had the tea and nuts at 9:45 this morning instead of like 11:30 this morning. Took the cookie bear out for a walk. She did her business and then ran back home because she hates being outside. She's been prepared for this quarantine COVID life her whole life. So look at that. And at some point, Cookie turns 6 years old because I've had her for 5 years and 2 months. And she was obviously not a newborn puppy when I got her, though I think she was within her first year. So at some point this year, Cookie will pass me and be older than me in dog years. So that's a real milestone. Anyway, I wrote a bunch of notes down for things to talk about. But off the bat, thank you for listening, guys. We had a good week last week, first week back after a while. So that was nice to see that we had some good listens and downloads. I have rejoined, not against my will, but against my better judgment and ethics. I have rejoined Facebook. So you can find me, J.L. Covan. Very annoying that I did that, but what I figure, and I won't lament this point because you've heard me say it many times. If you haven't been listening regularly for a while, then consider yourself lucky that you're being spared this complaint, this long-winded complaint. But the point is, Twitter. You know, in the last 2 months, I've lost 100 followers a day. Pretty much every day, and that could be bots, that could be people leaving Twitter, etc. And I'm sure at 140,000 plus followers, that's probably a normal rate of attrition. But when your posts are being suppressed, and not to sound like some right-wing dude, I don't know why my posts have been suppressed. If somebody could give me an answer, I'd gladly adjust the way I use Twitter. to not, but you know, there is no place to get answers. You're just at the whim of the algorithm. And one day you're picking up 140,000 followers in 6 months. And then for the next 6 months, you're losing 100 a day and picking up, you know, and that's a net of 100 a day. Cause I am picking up some followers here and there, but like, hey, I picked up 8 followers. But my posts, which were averaging, you know, probably 300,000 views for like 5 months, now get like 25,000 views if I'm lucky on Twitter, which is still good, but it's like practically comparable to what I was getting when I had 4,000 followers. Like a good post could get me 20,000 views when I had 4,000 followers. So it becomes just a question of like, what's the point and value of having 140,000 followers when you're being seen by such a small fraction of them, including people that engaged with me a lot. Like I happened to look at an old post and I was like, hey, that person like liked my posts and was commenting for like 5 months and disappeared, but they're still here on Twitter and they still follow me just as an experiment. So that's a very, I promised I wouldn't do that. But anyway, that's the point, is that Twitter helped me grow and expand. And now it's sort of, I see it, you know, because Twitter was my sole outlet, my sole social media outlet, you know, it as it declined, everything else I do has declined. Podcast is kind of holding steady, which is good. But my YouTube views are way down, which is frustrating because I'm doing other things, obviously, besides, I've done a few Chappelle videos. Obviously, I'm looking forward to the spring or summer where I can re-engage and collaborate with a lot of the people I used to do sketches with, that I would write the sketches. And now, it'd be great. Like I've told you previously, I'd like to put together a sketch hour, either as a pilot or just something to sell online or promote online. Cause I have a lot of sort of bigger sketches that I'm making do. I've done what I can. Obviously it helps that I can do lots of impressions and then I'm a stand-up, so I can keep pumping out weekly stand-up clips and, you know, videos, whether it's Chappelle, Mike Lindell, Mitch McConnell, the Andrew Cuomo one, a perfect example that I just put up this weekend, was doing really well. But then of course it just hit, the brakes got hit on Twitter. So it was like getting tons of views and then just kind of stopped, and slowed down considerably, but that, you know, got to like 25,000, but people really liked the Cuomo, and I was really proud of the Cuomo video. But on YouTube, of course, because it has to do with harassment, even though the video itself is really no cursing, it's just a comedy sketch where I basically allude to Cuomo like intimidating people and claiming he didn't harass while detailing harassing conduct. But they immediately flagged it for no ads. So it was like, oh good, this video is getting like a decent amount of views and now none of them will pay anything. So that's a long-winded, hopefully not too bitter sounding. I've really gotten the bitterness out of my system when it comes to this stuff. Now I can just deliver it in a factual way. But that's a long way of saying, I don't know how much more heat I have. I hope to book headlining gigs soon. I'm hoping to get a vaccine soon, and I'd like to book spring, summer, fall shows and arrange an album recording in Philadelphia sometime along that spectrum. And it will probably be a lucrative time for me relative to my previous years of stand-up gigs. But, you know, the most money I ever got from stand-up gigs, not counting streaming stuff, the most money I ever got from stand-up gigs in a single year was like $11,000. And that was like a year where it was like, oh shit, I booked like 17 feature gigs and like a private gig. And I think 11,000, if you exclude streaming royalties, and stuff like that, 11,000. Now that's as a feature, that's not as a headliner. So like, in my mind, I'm already lowering my expectations and saying, I mean, if I could make in a 12-month period right now, because my expectations are so reduced from what they were, you know, 10 months ago, if I can make 20 grand from like a collection of headlining gigs, that would be probably good. And maybe I'm lowballing myself, but without an agent or a manager, I don't know how much reach I have. I don't know what my market value is. So the point of all this is I rejoined Facebook because I thought this year, while I still have a big following and still have some heat, even though it's proven very difficult to convert, you know, progressive people who are shitty comedy fans into real comedy fans and to convince people who, like, I don't know. So I just figured Facebook, I don't like Facebook. I've been off it for 2.5 years, and obviously it probably would have helped me immensely this last year if I had been on Facebook, because I already had a big following on Facebook, and it would have just, you know, you see what happened on Twitter, the shit would have happened. Like, it goes without saying, the most views I got on my video for YouTube, which has like 2.6 million views, were through Facebook. So that was, I wasn't even on Facebook, and it was getting shared so much that was the largest generator of, you know, views for me was Facebook, just because the video was so talked about. So had I been on Facebook this whole year, you know what, who's to say it wouldn't have doubled my monetary value in terms of either cameos or just YouTube monetization. But whatever, I tried to do the ethical thing. Nobody really cared. There's no mass movement to leave Facebook. That doesn't mean it wasn't the right thing to do. But the point is, long-winded, people aren't seeing my stuff on Twitter. And it may be useless to say, hey, people who aren't seeing me on Twitter, please follow me on Facebook, because the logic would be that they wouldn't see me on Twitter saying that. But to just ensure that as many people see my stuff and that my stuff, you know, this isn't even about money. This is just about, I want people to see my comedy. Like, I know I'm good, and it's very frustrating to have this big following that's been sort of neutered. Not entirely, but just, like I've said, it feels like I got treated like a conservative, like, fake news account. Like I'm an OAN correspondent or something. It's very weird because I'm just a comedian, and I try to diversify what I do: stand-up clips, jokes, talking about the Utah Jazz. But I think all that I do that might have made me a more engaging follow for the Facebook algorithm seems to have hurt me on the Twitter algorithm. So that said, if you're on Facebook and you listen to this, I'd appreciate it if you would follow or friend me. Just, you know, JL Covan, facebook.com/JL Covan. It's very simple to find me. And also, if you're there and you haven't liked Making Podcasts Great Again on Facebook, please give that fan page a like. Very frustrated with the fact that I wasn't on Facebook. Our social media has basically followed whatever I've done. And it was very frustrating to see that we hadn't posted to Facebook in 2 months, which I would have not known because I wasn't on Facebook. And, you know, the answer was like, well, we don't get a lot of engagement there. And it's like, well, we're not working at the engagement there, so how could we get engagement there? So it's just all very frustrating. You know, that's my favorite thing about comedy, unfortunately, was I've said this on previous podcasts, maybe not this iteration, but my favorite thing, or at least the fantasy about comedy, was it's an individual sport, and I had full confidence, and I still have full confidence in my skills, my writing, the breadth of what I can bring to the table as a comedian. But it's not a team sport. Like, I wanted it to be tennis, you know, or track and field. But what it really is like race car driving or cycling, where it's like, yeah, you're individually doing your part, but there's a whole team around you, whether it be representation or other comedians blowing up that can help you. Like, and I didn't get into comedy to be, I don't mean this to sound selfish. I played team sports, in college. I, you know, care about family and friends, but when it came to comedy, the part of the allure was that I could bet on myself and have full confidence in what I was bringing to the table. And I've never really disappointed myself when it comes to stand-up or content. Like, I'm very proud of the tremendous body of work that I've put out, but it hasn't been enough. Even this year, you know, like I said, I had a friend reach out to some agents and they haven't even gotten back to him. So something like, I don't know what, I'm not really sure what to do from now on. So I guess going to Facebook was just a desperation move of like, well, let's try a different algorithm and see if I can, get new eyeballs and stuff to share my content, you know? So, like I said, if you're there, follow me, friend me, whatever. You know, same stuff I'm going to put out. 2 podcasts every week, 3 or 4 videos a week, stand-up clip every Saturday, blog post hopefully weekly. It's just becoming very tough because I'm trying to write sketches on the weekend, and then I am working on a potential long-term big budget project, which I might know by April or May if that's going to be sort of funded and maybe allow me the freedom to really think hard about leaving the day job, which, as I've said to you on this podcast, I'm very hesitant to do because for the very reasons that I just described. I never, 2019, I didn't move to Jersey and take a day job at a law firm because I had lost faith in my own skills. I did it because I had lost faith in the comedy business. And now, after 2020, a year that basically gave me insomnia, both from the positives that were happening to me, but then seeing what the world preferred, it was almost the equivalent of when maybe a religious person becomes atheist is the only thing I could think of in terms of your whole world. Just, you can either become comfortable with it or despair, but it will shake your entire worldview. When I saw the content that was sort of being produced and praised in 2020, after I'd had my rise, and I had a bunch of great fans who are still fans and a lot of respect and a lot of love still. So I don't want this to sound ungrateful. But when you realize, A, how poor the sense of humor of so many people is, and then you see what becomes it up close, you know, maybe because I felt like I was so close to achieving something bigger, it was almost an existential comedy crisis is the way I might phrase it, because I was just like, this whole time I've been trying to please the industry and try to get recognition that I still can't get for some reason, whatever. But the real terror was when I was like, oh, this is what like the wider comedy world like wants. And now, it really fucked me up in 2020 because it was more like my faith in comedy itself had been shaken. I posted a joke and had to delete it many, many months ago. It was a quote from the great Greg Giraldo at the roast of Larry the Cable Guy when he looked over at Larry the Cable Guy and said, "Why are you so popular?" And there was real truth in Giraldo. Like, Giraldo, from all that I've heard, was a really nice guy. But you know, he was a real thinker and a real comedian. And there was real venom in that, even though he wasn't saying it to be mad at Larry the Cable Guy. I think he was just saying there was a little, the truth in it that made it funny was that Greg Giraldo is an elite, great, all-time stand-up comedian. And he makes a fraction of what the Cable Guy makes. And I don't think he was mad at Larry the Cable Guy. He's mad. It almost sounds like a cry in angst at comedy itself. And that's sort of how I felt in 2020. So going into 2021, you know, like I said, I have one project that potentially could be a game changer financially, at least for a couple of years. It's a YouTube project. So I'm not trying to get you guys thinking that I'm making a movie with Judd Apatow. Like, it's a YouTube project, but I think it could be something that would be a good fit for me and potentially give me another year or two of financial cushion, which would then make me think, is it now worth quitting the day job? And honestly, writing a book and trying to book my own shows and see where that goes. Like, I have a lot of good stuff in my head. But you know, a day job, et cetera, and just stressing over the choices I have to make is a real drain day to day. But the point is, this is what a weird intro to be like, and that's why I'm joining Facebook, because I gave up. I haven't given up, but it's like I said, like I've said before, I don't have another 10 years to, I don't have another decade to like fight and try to establish myself. If they don't like me at 40, they definitely won't like me at 50. So I just have to figure out where I'm going. And I couldn't, while I still have a platform that's bit substantial, I just figured, hey, follow me on Facebook too, because maybe you're missing stuff on Twitter or YouTube, and now you just increased your chances of seeing my stuff. If you presumably you're a fan of mine and you like my stuff, so just follow or friend me on Facebook. And if I don't sound enthusiastic, it's because I'm not, because I'm not joining Facebook because I miss the camaraderie and like going back to a site where so many people didn't follow me to other sites, like free social media sites. It let me know like my comedy, and this isn't personal, but it's a harsh lesson of no matter how good I was as a comedian, I wasn't worth friends, and many friends and fans didn't think it was worth their time to follow me to other free social media sites to keep up with my comedy, which is a really, it's not a hurtful thing, like an intentionally hurtful thing, but you start to realize how cheap the work of your life, of your adult life has been. And because it's the people who really like you who still in many cases don't consider it worth their time to join a different site. Like my big joke that I told, I think I said on this podcast, but I said it to the Righteous Girlfriend this weekend. I said, you know what, if I could predict my future, what I would say is I managed to sell a stand-up special and a sketch special to HBO Max. Okay. Everybody's looking for content. Bop, 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 bop. I sell it. I put up on fucking Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Oh man, here's the poster for my like double special. Like, look at me. I'm doing stand up and a sketch. This is it. The dream's coming true. HBO. I know Netflix is bigger, but HBO, a comedian of my age and experience, HBO is the fucking holy grail. My favorite special of all time was Chris Rock, Bring the Pain, and my special will now be on the same platform as his. Dreams come true. And I could genuinely see like 10% of my fans going, oh, good for JL, so happy. But I don't get HBO Max, so, but good luck. And that's one of those things where you're like, I always say I would have been a better stand-up comedy fan than most fans. Like if Gary Goldman had a special on Showtime and I didn't have Showtime, guess what I'm ordering for that month? Showtime. Like, it's just it's a weird thing we're in. I just know that would happen, that people would be like, oh my God, I don't get HBO Max, but if you do, you should watch my favorite comedian, J.L. Covan. I'd be like, well, why don't you order HBO Max? I'm already predicting like the downside of a fantasy coming true. That's where my head is at. So how about that for a 22-minute intro into why you should friend me on Facebook? Okay. Trust me. And the thing about whatever. It's, it is what it is. I fought the law and the law won, and now I'm back on Facebook because I just don't want to lose the momentum I have until I can get out into shows, and I don't know how many shows I'm going to book, and I don't know what the demand will be for me. I'd love it to be great because I know I don't fuck up on stage. Like, the thing about being a feature, it's being a middle act is like, it's frustrating. You feel like you hit a ceiling. The pay hasn't increased in fucking my lifetime, I think. You know, it's $100 a show in 1988, and it's $100 a show in 2021. And that's fucking insane. But you do it because you feel like you're closer to your dream. You're performing for strangers at great comedy clubs, or sometimes not great comedy clubs, but you're doing, you know, the difference between a headliner and a feature, you both have to fly to the or take the train or bus to the gig. Most of the time you both get a hotel room. But the difference is you do 25 minutes, they do 45 minutes, and they get paid anywhere from triple to 25 times what you get paid a show. maybe 25 is a little much, but 10 times what you're getting, anywhere from triple to 10 times a show, what you're getting, that's the difference. But you're still doing what the headliner is doing, 90% or 75% of the same experience. So you get to be close to that dream and experience sort of a sizable sample of what that dream is like. And I don't know what's out there. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, when all these clubs open up, obviously the A-listers are going to get first dibs. And I think that's why you see a lot of B-list comedians jumping at the chance to work Florida, Texas, et cetera. And I don't begrudge them from a professional standpoint, but I'm not prepared to do that. I'm not prepared to go to states that don't give a fuck about COVID and like get into rooms with a bunch of people not wearing a mask who don't give a shit, you know? So I got to find that balance, and I'm hoping to get vaccinated. And I have one show lined up in like Southern Jersey, like 15 minutes outside of Philly, I think, April 27th, Tuesday, April 27th. So my dream is to be fully vaccinated by then, still take all the precautions. But then once I'm fully vaccinated or know when I have my second shot or whatever, or my Johnson & Johnson one shot scheduled, that's when I can contact as many clubs as I can, ones I've worked, ones that maybe might be open to me working them, even though I've never worked them before. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know if any of that's going to happen, which is weird. You know, you know, you try not to be the Trump guy, and then half your fans are going, I want more Trump. And then you don't know where that, you know, you try to convince people to watch your stand-up, but then your Twitter algorithm doesn't let people see your stand-up. And then you're like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know. And then you say to people, sign up for my newsletter, please. Like, it's a free thing. It's once a month, but it just, at least you'll know my shows. And, you know, this year I had like 800 people sign up for my newsletter. So I'm over 1,000 people getting my newsletter each month. That's good. But, you know, it'd be nice if it was 20,000. Because then that's something you can work. That's something you can bank on. That's something you can depend on. So I don't know. I just don't. I've sort of lost my faith in the whole enterprise, but I have a good new hour to go through, and I don't leave work on the bench. I'm gonna get a new album this year. I'm gonna put together a sketch hour, sort of special, and we'll see what, in the words of Donald Trump, we'll see what happens. Right. Also this month. Since I have no shows to promote or anything, my whole promotion is just please follow me or sign up for free things I'm doing. But the one thing that will cost you money that I am promoting is either this month or next month, and I need to wait to hear from the people at the charity to know when they want people to start soliciting and promoting. But I'm an ambassador for the Hike for Haiti challenge. For Hope for Haiti, like a highly rated, reputable charity that works in Haiti on a variety of issues, a lot of it dealing with like education and children's health. But I'm an ambassador for that, so they want me to help raise money. So at some point this month on this podcast and on other platforms, I will be pushing my donation page. My amount that I said I would try to raise or my goal is $5,000, but I think I can easily exceed that. I hope I can, because look, guys, this is just if you're a good person. It has nothing to do with comedy. yeah, so that's, I kind of said, I have a show at the end of April, so next month I'm going to want to promote, you know, some comedy stuff, but if I can, if they're good with it being promoted this month, that's pretty much the only thing I'm going to be asking people to spend money on is, Hope for Haiti. So look for that, I guess, or don't. So I wrote down a couple of things. Golden Globes. I don't like, honestly, I love awards shows, especially movie awards shows. And I love Tina Fey, so obviously I usually would be very gung-ho for Golden Globes. But this year has totally just whacked out my priorities. Like, I just feel like I have no time anymore for anything I want to do. It's weird, because I do have some time, but I didn't play a video game. I haven't played a video game in a year. Literally a year. Not like, oh, it's been a while. No. In a year, I have yet to touch my PlayStation. And I have like 8 games sitting there that I want to play, but I just never do because I'm always like, I have 45 minutes. What do I do? Well, I'll read for 45 minutes or, oh, I'll veg out in front of the news before I have to do comedy content or day job work. So I haven't played a game in a year. Barely watched any sports unless it was a Utah Jazz game in the bubble. This year I've been watching more Jazz games, but I don't even know if I watched the NBA Finals last year. I didn't watch the World Series. I just found myself not watching or doing anything that I usually like to do. Movies feel more like a chore. Maybe this is just depression. I don't know. But movies felt like a chore. There were a few movies I liked and a few shows I really liked, for sure. But like more and more, I like found myself turning movies off after an hour going, why am I watching this like it's a chore? So like last night was the first time in a long time that I just like Righteous Girlfriend had the show on, but I was just walking around the apartment doing other stuff. But I just felt like it's not even that I want her to watch something else. Like, let's watch this instead. I was just like, I don't care. And I wish there was some sort of reason, but I just maybe just increase in apathy or something. But yeah, normally I'd talk about the Golden Globes, but I was like, I don't give a shit. People fly. I don't know. I hate when I talk like this because I don't want to sound like people that I really disagree with and think are vile. But sometimes you watch an award show and by like the fourth person talking about representation and inclusivity, you're just kind of like, all right. It's not that I disagree. You're just like, all right, that person said it, this person said it, the Hollywood Foreign Press like flogged themselves for lack of diversity, and we just, it's like, okay, great. I've never been a keep your politics out of it, et cetera. It just gets repetitive, I think, is my point. not that I'm like against the message, but I'm also like, all right, yeah, and... It wasn't a terrible year, was it? I mean, like a show or two gets snubbed, but at the same time, you're like, well, The Crown was fucking awesome. And we had what, 3 women directors nominated? 2 were women of color. I don't know. I just found myself last night really like being like, I don't care at all. Like I usually do. And I know it's a stupid thing to care about, but I like the Oscars. I like Golden Globes. Like I do. I'm competitive and I like movies. So like it's a perfect match. But I just found and I don't know why. I don't know if it was like some sort of apathy or depression or if I'm just getting older and crankier. But so I would normally talk about the Golden Globes, but I really don't have anything to talk about with the Golden Globes. I thought 40-Year-Old Virgin was the best movie of the year. It wasn't nominated. But I didn't claim it was because they fucking hate black women because they nominated a bunch of other stuff. It was a small indie film. I thought Borat was definitely the best comedy of the year. And as far as TV shows, I think The Crown, my 2 favorite shows of 2020. I don't know if there was there a season of Narcos in 2020? Because that's like pretty much always going to be my favorite show any year that Narcos is on. But Narcos just continually gets disrespected, and I think that's partly Netflix ignoring it, like choosing not to hype it up. But that's also been a big thing, and I'm going to put this into a stand-up bit, but I've already tweeted it multiple years where I'm like, anytime white people deal drugs, it is gritty and Oscar-worthy, or Emmy-worthy, I should say. Breaking Bad, one of my favorite shows of all time, one of the greatest shows of all time. But if there's a show about drug culture that could be considered better than Breaking Bad, it's The Wire. But The Wire never won a single fucking Emmy and never got nominated for Best Drama and never had a single acting nomination. Breaking Bad just racked up win after win after win in all those categories. Ozark, a show I really like. Lots of nominations and some wins for acting and directing. And Narcos, never nominated for any Emmys. So there you go. Like not even a, so I think part of that is probably because Netflix is probably pushing Ozark and not pushing Narcos, especially foreign press. You'd be like, well, you know, they tend to sort of favor a little bit more foreign based work. You look at The Crown. But and then, you know, what else? Even Weeds, which was like a drug comedy about a white lady selling drugs, that got, I think she won an Emmy for best lead actress in a comedy. And then to compare it to maybe if you need another, like maybe Snowfall, which I remember quitting Snowfall when it first premiered because I thought it was just like a little too graphic and sensational. You know, like in the pilot episode, like some woman's snorting coke off a guy's asshole or something. Not, they don't show fully, but you get my point. And I was like, okay, so this is just like a little extra testosterone bro-y, but doesn't feel as based in reality. Like it's there to be like a little juiced up to get more buzz. But I gave it another chance on FX, and now I'm fully caught up, and I'm caught up with this current season. But after watching it, there's a lot more to the show, and it's a strong show. I don't think it's as good as Breaking Bad or The Wire. I wouldn't put it in that class, but I'd put it in the, and I wouldn't put it in the Breaking Bad class, but I'd put it in the, I put it in the Ozark class. You know what I mean? Like I'd put it in that level. And this isn't me saying Ozark shouldn't be nominated, but it's just after, when you look after 20 years, when like any drug show involving black or brown people doesn't even get mentioned, and every drug show with white people seems to be hailed as like gritty, next level TV, you start to just go, it's no longer a coincidence. But nobody ever really talks about that. It's just like, that's to me much, to toot my own horn, that's a little bit more of a substantive argument than no black women were nominated this year or no Latin, whatever. Like it's the same way I feel about diversity in comedy. There are places to make that argument, but a lot of the time it's a fucking lazy version of the argument. Like whenever, to me in comedy, I've said this so many times, but you could put together any show you want with talented people of different races and genders. You could, and you should. But I feel like industry-wide, they always take, not always, but it seems like sometimes they often take the lazy way out, which is they find some squeaky wheel who meets demographic criteria, whereas if they did the hard work and went to clubs and watched more video and did real sort of scouting, they'd find better versions of what they promote. But it's like, I think sometimes in the entertainment business, it's just, it becomes, we need a black woman. We need a Latin man. It's caliente comedy tonight. We just get it. And sometimes it feels like, and I can't support this entirely with data, and I'm not going to name names of folks who I think are mediocre, but have skyrocketed because of meeting a certain demo. But you do a disservice, I think, when you do the lazy way out, because you don't have to, like, you can get representation if you don't take the late, if you're willing to put in the work, you can get representation and the highest level of talent. That's, I genuinely believe that because I've seen it. I've made this point before. When I'm touring comedy clubs and I look at the menus, not the menus, but like on the back of the menu, it might have like coming up in the next 3 months, and you'll see a remarkable amount of black headliners. But they'll be like people my age and older, sometimes much older, because they bring an audience. But they aren't getting, these aren't the acts that are necessarily getting TV deals. It's a 28-year-old with 15 minutes who's getting the TV deal because, oh, we're looking for diversity. And it's like, but you're not, you're reward, like in that case, you're only rewarding in many cases the demographic and not the talent plus demographic. As the Supreme Court said with affirmative action, it could be used as a plus factor, but not as necessarily the only determinative factor. And that's how it feels sometimes in entertainment. And then when you watch like an awards show, it feels like everybody's bending over backwards just to say the platitudes, while almost sometimes ignoring the fact like, I know maybe I May Destroy You got overlooked. And that, I found that so funny. Like, I May Destroy You was a really good show this year, and I was surprised it didn't get nominated, especially because it's also British with the foreign press. But The flip of that is like, but there were a lot of different kinds of movies nominated. There was more representation, but it becomes like you take the one piece of evidence and you go, well, this is a disgrace. And it's like, it could be a disgrace artistically because I think most people have it as like one of the top shows of the year, but it's weird to be like coming out and I, oh God, I saw one, I remember this and it's such easy Twitter. It's such easy Twitter boosting, but was like the what's that? Some dumb show I've never watched. Emily in Paris. They're like, so Emily in Paris gets nominated, but I May Destroy You does not. Don't tell me we don't have a racial problem in this country. And I was like, okay, first of all, I May Destroy You is a foreign show. Secondly, it's the foreign press voting on it. I'm not excusing certain things, but I was like, it always strikes me as odd when it's like, so we got Nomadland winning best director, Asian woman. We have multiple black actors winning prestigious awards. This isn't a, I'm not doing a running tally, but it's such a weird, like, people are so, I don't get it because I feel like I'm always stuck in the middle on these things where I agree with the values of the left, but some of the messengers on the left are really just like, I'm gonna like working hard for Twitter love. And when I remember seeing the Emily in Paris, I was like, well, I didn't watch that shit and I hear it's not that good. So I guess that's messed up. But award shows mess up shit all the time, like on all sorts of levels. And it didn't feel like, I felt like there was, I don't want to say enough or not enough, but I felt like there seemed to be some diversity among the nominees in terms of directing, acting, TV, and movies. And it was just, but you pick out one and then like it becomes, you can say like at some point, sometimes I should say, not at some point, but sometimes, you know, maybe I May Destroy You wasn't nominated because award shows do stupid things. It might not have been their disdain for black women like that and white supremacy destroying award shows. Like sometimes it's not that. Those things can be present and can be an issue, but it's like sometimes you're just like, is it just that they fucked up? Like this one might have just been a fuck up and not a white supremacy fuck up. I don't know. It's just, it seems weird when you're looking at these particular awards going, I don't know, there seemed to be better representation than usual. And just like when The Dark Knight didn't get nominated for Best Picture, I was like, that's bullshit. But sometimes I think it can just be a fuck up. And sometimes the fuck up happens to a black show versus what I say, which is like, I'm showing you 20 years of a pattern, not one aberration in 2020, but like The Wire, Narcos, Snowfall versus Breaking Bad, Ozark, and Weeds. I think there you have a much more compelling case because that's stretching practically over multiple generations at this point. In terms of what shows get awarded and what don't. I don't know. So that's, I just, overall, just my general mood and my, you know, I just, like, it was the first awards show, like, the first time I really just felt like I didn't give a shit, which is sad because I really like movies and I really like awards shows. So I hope that's not a permanent affliction that I've developed in my disdain for awards shows. And what I was going to do is, I was thinking about starting, not a second podcast, but like an offshoot of this. And I've been talking to somebody who wants me to get started with like a Patreon-esque page. And what's frustrating about that is my guilty conscience. I know I have some really good fans. I complain a lot, but I know I have some really good fans, some really loyal fans, appreciative fans who've dived into my whole, the J.L. Covan cinematic universe, whether it's stand-up, all the impressions, the blogs, the podcasts. Like I am very grateful, and I know I can sound like I'm not grateful, but it's often easier for me to complain about all the things that are annoying me than to just say thank you to the people who are still seeing my stuff and are either not victims of the algorithm or are just dedicated fans who seek my stuff out. So I do appreciate it. But then there's this always this push to like monetize, get your fans to monetize your career. And for me, my mentality has still always been the money I want to make is from selling my albums and performing in clubs. And that's what I want to do. That's how I want to make my money. But as we get stuck inside, you know, there becomes this push of like, well, if you start, it's not Patreon, but it's a sort of startup company that's been working with me on, if you bought tickets to any of my shows, or bought the USB card with my albums on it, Jemmy. So you're familiar with it if you've been to that site. But they kind of want to start like they're looking to push like, you know, like monthly memberships. And then it's like, oh, but if you do like, okay, you can do a monthly show that members get access to. You can discount things if they're monthly members. You can. And I thought, well, I could do like a new bonus podcast. And the thing I was thinking about doing is since I complain about comedy so much, I thought, what if I do a bonus podcast where each week I talk about somebody else, either a TV show, an actor, a stand-up comedian, et cetera, that I think is also underrated. So I take my energy, my self-pitying comedy energy, and I become an advocate for someone else's comedy career. And I was thinking about doing that, but I'm still not comfortable. I'm still not because if I had a million fans, I'd feel like, you know, then you become, no offense, but you become less individually attached to your fans. So you become, and you can say, well, I'm a much bigger quote unquote brand or comedian star. So like I should be putting out more stuff for people. And because I've reached a certain level of stardom, I'm almost expected to produce more stuff for profit. But at this point, I just feel like I've got these thousands, maybe, definitely hundreds, but probably several thousand kind of loyal fans, but they pick and choose what they like. And the suggestion to me was like, oh, if you use the Jemmy platform, you know, you could give for X dollars a month, they get early access to your videos, they get like access to shows, they get access to, and I was like, yeah, but I feel like I have to reconfigure how I've been approaching my entire career to start doing that. It's a weird mindset that I don't really have yet. Because then I thought, okay, well, this podcast, or why don't I just do an extra episode of Righteous Prick each week, like an offshoot series, or even start a different podcast? Because I was just like, if I have to just milk the fans I have now for whatever, and you know what? I know I'm putting out good stuff, and I know there's people who like what I produce. So I'm not pretending like you're just doing it out of fucking charity. I'm really good at a lot of different comedy things, but there comes a limit where you're like, okay, so for like Making Podcasts Great Again, we have some ad dollars coming in, and we have like between 220 and 240 Patreon subscribers a month. But that's for a podcast with like over like 11 to 13,000 downloads a week. So that's not a high percentage. So most people just want, and that's the Trump. That's my fastball of 2020. And we're all, you know, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't want to be ungrateful to we had like 38 Patreons before we ended our Patreon in 2019. We were just like, it's not worth, like, we're not making enough money and it's not worth it to just be like doubling our content. Well, at 230 subscribers, it was worth it because it was like an extra X dollars a month for each of us. But I don't want to I want to expand. If I'm only going to get like 0.3% of fans to pony up money, I don't want it to be the same 0.3%. I want to grow and then have those people maybe come get extras. But I feel like now with where my career and my metrics are at, I feel like I'd just be like asking the same 300 people to like, will you support me as I try to find ways to make more content for you? And I'm more inclined to just be like, here, have some more fucking content, because I appreciate the people, the real ones who are with me. And let's hope that algorithms and some agent somewhere all conspire to elevate my career again. But it just feels weird to be, and I'm not ruling it out, by the way. I am thinking, could I do extra podcasts? Could I do extra videos or give early access to videos? Could I do, in addition to that, a monthly show that everybody would be entitled to show up for if they're a member? Some of that sounds like worthwhile content to me. And please, either on Twitter or even better, if you go to this podcast episode on Podomatic, because comments there can help the algorithm there, leave your feedback on the Podomatic page for this episode. If there's a thing that you'd think about joining, let me know. I might as well create like a, what is it, what is like administrative law? What do they do? Public comment. This is our like month for public commentary before we issue new rules on the podcast and the JL content universe. But leave a comment on the Podomatic page. Everybody has access to it. It's not a social media site. It's on my website. If you just click, it's one of the tabs underneath the Righteous PK podcast. You just click on Podomatic, go to this episode and log in, join the podcast. It costs literally, it's nothing. But I've always wanted to use those as more of a chat room for this podcast. So please do that if you are not a follower of Righteous PK on Podomatic. And let me know. My inclination is to say, okay, rather than just doing, hey guys, new event, I do a show each month. We make it different in some ways. Maybe I invite a guest on. We can figure that out. But like if I did a monthly show, like a monthly stand-up character interview Zoom show, if I did a bonus podcast each week, but something different, like I said, like Unsung Heroes of Comedy or JL Defends, you know, JL's comedy defense as like an offshoot podcast, early access to videos or a bonus video. Like, is $10 a month too much, too little? Is that something is it even something you'd be interested in? Because like I say, I'm hesitant because I want to keep growing the fan base, not just saying, hey, my, you know, Leonidas's army of 300 fans, I need to have you paying more for content. I don't want to do that. I want something that is, if I choose to go that route, I'd like it to be something that I don't feel guilty about, that I feel like I'm actually putting in substantial work and earning it. And then I'd like it if, like, you know, 500 or 700 people joined, not just 80 people. Because then I'll feel even more guilty, and then I'll just become more bitter because I'm like, I have to do this because I do have these wonderful, loyal, small group of fans that's with me. So just some food for thought. But please, if I can request one thing besides 5-star reviews on Apple, it would be if we could create, if you're listening to me now, you don't have to listen to it on Podomatic, though you can, and some people do. If you listen on Spotify or Apple, I would just request sign up at Podomatic. Just, it's like an email password, and then you can like the episodes and you can comment on the episode. And at least for this one, let's maybe have a sort of chat room-like atmosphere so that I can get, if there's stuff you like, if there's stuff you would want to see, would you want to see me interview people once a month in like a Zoom chat? Totally, that's something I would totally consider. A Zoom, you know, would you find that interesting? Would you find it funny? Something you might like, me in my own voice. Would you like to see one of my impressions have their own weekly or monthly show? Is the idea this JL defending unsung heroes of comedy? And obviously it'd be very funny stuff and bitter. I'm going to do that, but should I make that? Is that something that you think would be worth paying for? So what I'm asking basically is, for $10 or $15 a month, or five, I don't know how the tiers would be, but let's say a range of 5 to 15 a month. If I was doing a week, honestly, I hate to say this, if I'm doing a monthly show, a weekly bonus podcast, and early access to videos, I think that's worth $20 a month, but I don't know if I want to do it at all. But I think that is a $20 a month value. And the shows don't always have to be the same. One, it could be an interview with somebody. It could be a stand-up hour. It could be a character-driven hour. You know, once I start doing sketches with more people, it could be early access to those sketches. Obviously, I'm going to want to make them public, but you know, things like that. And other bonus features, they sometimes, you know, I don't know. The point is, I don't know. You can help me on this. The more feedback I get, the better. And you can be honest. Be honest like a respectful fan, though. I'm assuming if you listen to this podcast, you're a respectful fan. But I don't need the person. Like, I remember blocking a guy on Twitter. And then he went to, like, my Instagram or YouTube to complain about me. And I was like, get the fuck. Obviously, it didn't hurt your feelings because you found me on another platform to. But he, I said, hey, guys, we're just informal poll. Why don't you, if you do not, if you are not a member of our Patreon, this was for Making Podcasts Great Again. I said, if you're not a member of our Patreon, could you let us know the reason? One reason was too expensive. Reason two was, like, not enough content. Reason three was didn't know about it. And reason four was like not interested or something. And so we got some, you know, some people were like, you know, honestly, like times and understanding that money might be an issue where people are like, I don't want to spend 10 extra bucks or 5 extra bucks a month on a totally frivolous thing. I already get a free episode and money's tight. I lost my job. Totally all acceptable. But one guy wrote, there's just too much free content for me to pay for this. And I took that as like, I took it as kind of a, it was like an unnecessary, like, you're so dumb for charging. And I was like, I then wrote to him, I was like, do you, just curious, do you listen to the free podcast? And he goes, I check it out sometimes or something to that degree. And then I just blocked him because I was just like, I don't know why this guy thought this exchange was a chance for him to like talk down to me. Do you know what I mean? Like it was just, there was a condescending tone to it that I was like, I'm trying to have a constructive conversation here about how we can better reach our fans. And if you're a fan, why are you like talking down? Like I check, like it wasn't that though. It was like worse than that in terms of how he said it. You know, just the tone was clearly condescending and it was like, unnecessarily condescending. It was like, you don't have to exchange, you don't have to comment or anything. Like if you don't give a shit about the show, but it's like this chance to be like, I listen, okay. Or like, I've heard a little bit of some episodes. It was just like something like that. And I was like, but you're still following it. And like, and then his response on YouTube, when he hunted me down to let him know, this guy is so sensitive, he blocks people just because they don't listen to enough of his podcast. And I was like, no, it's not that. You don't have to listen to it at all. It was the way you exchanged with me. So the point being, if you have any constructive criticism or any ideas, if there's no way you'd pay because of a certain circumstance, or if there are things you would pay for, and they could be anything. It can be like, I don't know, not anything, but you know what I mean. Like if there's things that you like that I do that you might think, oh, I'd like to see more of that, or I'd like to see him do this in a more intimate private show setting, or I'd like to see this during a stand-up, or I'd like to hear him podcast this, or I'd like to hear him interview these types of people. All suggestions are welcome. And I'm sorry this became like a long infomercial, but as you can tell from the breadth of this podcast, I don't want to be an internet comedian person for life. This is a stopgap. I want to perform at clubs. I want to come to your city. I want to hang out with you after a show. I want to give you an hour. I want you to bring your friends out or your grandmother who might be a huge fan of mine from my YouTube videos. But this isn't what I want to do, but this is a way of making the best out of a situation where I have a lot of creativity and comedy that I'd like to share. I'd like to make some money at it, obviously, but I don't want to bully or manipulate 50 of you into being paying customers. I'd like to deliver, if there is something you think I could or should do that you would want to pay for on a monthly basis, my ideas so far are bonus podcast, but like in a different direction, whether I interview people on bonus episodes, whether I talk about comedy in a different way, like these sort of defending unsung heroes of comedy. And I do have a list of them. I have a list already made that I think would be very good. Ideally, I could interview these people, but I don't think that's happening. So believe me, if I could interview the people on my list, I would definitely be charging for it. I think it would be worth, but the, you get the point. So your homework assignment, if you choose to accept it, is to just, let's try to turn the Podomatic page for this podcast into the chat room where you give me suggestions or you comment on the episodes. It helps the podcast algorithm and it allows you to weigh in week to week. And I know many of you won't do this, but I'm telling you, algorithmically, it will help. And it will also, for this particular episode, give me needed useful feedback either way. So I guess that's it. Podomat, I forget what my Podomat, but it's, if you go to my website, jlcomedy.com, click on podcast, you'll see the two logos for Righteous Prick and for Making Podcasts Great Again. Just click on the Podomatic tab to take you to the page for the show, and then go to this episode and give me some feedback. So I'd like to, you know, by the weekend, I hope I have a lot of comments there one way or the other. And honestly, I don't even mind if you put like a price range. It's a free, this is the town hall. This is an annual JL town hall on my Podomatic page to let me know, you know, yes, I'd pay. No, I wouldn't pay. $20 is a little steep. $10 would be the sweet spot. I would pay $20 if you were to deliver A, B, C, and D each month. I would be intrigued with that at least. And once again, these are the kinds of things that price adjustments could be made. Once I'm touring, though, a lot of this stuff would probably go away because I'd be like, hey, you know what? Instead of paying $20 a month, pay $20 for a ticket when I'm in your city, you know, or $10 for the new album. Once things get back to normal, but this is, I'm looking to have, I don't know. I'm rambling now, but I think I've been pretty clear on this, and hopefully one way or the other, you guys can give me feedback that's constructive and we can figure out if this is worth starting up in April or not. I will leave you on one sad note, and it happened almost a week ago now. I found out a few days ago, Eric Myers, who many of you probably don't know. Some of you might, comedians might. He was this comedian. His birthday, I believe, was yesterday/today because he was born on February 29th in 1980. And he was in a car accident. It was unclear, but I believe he was in a car accident in outside of Dallas or in Dallas. He was supposed to be performing at Hyenas Comedy Club there. And he died. And sadly, when I heard he had died, when I just caught it on Twitter, someone had retweeted something and I was like, oh my God, I just assumed, I think he was somebody who had had some drug issues. And I unfortunately assumed it had been drug related. And it wasn't. And as I learned more, he had lost his father a few weeks ago to cancer. And you know, after last week's episode talking about death and mortality, it was, very sad to hear that. Now, Eric Myers, Eric Myers is was actually kind of, in a weird way, an inspiration, a serious inspiration for my idea of doing like sort of unsung comedy heroes, where me as an outspoken defender of what I consider real comedy and real stand-up comedy, this podcast, this offshoot would be funny, but it would also come with a lot of credibility, I think, in terms of what I think is funny and who I think deserves more respect. And it's not all about hyping up unknown comedians. Like, I'll just give you a hint. Dane Cook is on the list and I've jotted down several reasons that many of you probably wouldn't even guess, but it will make sense. The actor who played Stevie Janowski on Eastbound and Down is on my list. So I think I will end up doing this even if I don't charge extra, but I'm once again, just looking for a beam. But it was Eric Myers' passing that kind of inspired me to start thinking that way, because I spend a lot of time, in fact, on this episode, I've spent more time complaining about, I don't know if anybody's complained more about comedy and their comedy career in the history of comedy than me. but Eric Myers was a guy who made me step back a little bit and realize, like, it made me sad on many levels. And of course, when I found out his father had just passed away from cancer, it made me even sadder on a personal level. But as a comedian, I often lament not getting my due. I can't get an agent. It's very frustrating, etc. But Eric Myers was one of two comedians, I'd say three comedians if I'm being honest, that sort of inspired me to get involved with stand-up comedy. My journey into stand-up comedy began at a friend's bachelor party. It was like an engagement party. And he didn't end up marrying this woman, but he married another lovely lady, and they have a family. But we were at the engagement party, and I this was my group of friends that were 2 years older than me at Williams. I think, and I don't think it was a coincidence that a lot of my closest friends from Williams were in the class 2 years ahead of me, and almost all of them had younger siblings, and I have an older sibling, and I think there was a not so subtle surrogacy going on in terms of like I was the loudmouth comedic baby brother, and they were the older brother replacements, if you will, in terms of just the friendship. But I was kind of holding court, and my friend Scott said, I think he was the one who suggested stand-up comedy, because he said, if you do stand-up comedy, I'll be at your first show. And as a point of pride, he ended up showing up to my first show at the DC Improv on like a Wednesday night in DC, like drove down from Philly, because he's that type of guy. And we could have this great laugh about it, because for him and for me, the pride was almost less in being at my first big show and more about, remember when I said that like 15 months ago? Bam, here I am. But it was, I think he was the one who suggested that I try stand-up comedy, and I was kind of like, eh. And then if he wasn't the one who suggested, he was definitely the one who said, if you try stand-up comedy, I will be at your first show, your first big show or whatever. So he was there. But that was the summer before, that was the summer after my first year of law school. But my second year of law school, I was super depressed. I mean, super depressed, for a variety of reasons. And I needed a hobby, and a guy in my building was handing out a flyer, to a local comedy show. And I was in this space. I've told this story before, but I was like having lunch on a weekly basis with this priest from Georgetown, because my then girlfriend, who was a med student at Ohio State, we started dating at Williams, and then we're in a long distance relationship throughout grad school. She just figured I wasn't going to go talk to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so she called. She knew I was depressed. I just thought I was like, I'm not depressed. I just like drinking a lot and not getting out of bed for class. So she called Georgetown and spoke to Father, this father, who then showed up to my door one day. And you look at, you know, me, nice Catholic boy. You look through your peephole, and there's a priest on the other side of the peephole. You're like, I kind of chuckled. I was like, Kelly, yeah, I know this was you. And it was like The Exorcist. It was like my comedy career began with Father Merrick showing up to my gloomy house in DC. I think it all works, folks. The Exorcist took place in Washington, DC. So like my origin story as a comedian is basically Father Merrick coming and saying, the power of Christ compels you, like get over your funk. And so I needed a hobby. I needed a, you know, he didn't suggest it, but it was just, he got me in this headspace of like getting me out of school and getting me out of like being in my long distance relationship and being lonely and feel, you know, other issues I was having. So at this time, a guy is in my building handing out little flyers, and he goes, oh, hey man. Like, you know, you see somebody in the elevator. I'm a young guy. So he's like, oh, you should come by, I forget the name of the bar. Because I keep thinking of the names of the bars. There's Irish Times and the Dubliner were the two bars near the law school. And then in my neighborhood, I forget the bar, but it was a bar like, you know, one of my favorite things of being in DC, this will age me, but I felt a lot of independence. And if I could have redone it, I would have definitely not had a girlfriend. If I had known, we wouldn't be married and she would marry somebody from her medical school, I would have just nipped it in the bud. And if I had also known how badly I wanted to be a single man in Washington, D.C. But all I can say is when you're a jacked law student at Georgetown Law School, you might as well play for the Washington Wizards. That's all I'll say about that. But but I just was like, I'll go to the bar. Like, cool. I talked to my friend Patrick, who I called Pat throughout law school, and I didn't realize until like our fifth year reunion at Georgetown that I was like, you go by Patrick, don't you? And this is one of my closest friends in law school. And it was always hilarious to be like, I just naturally call people shorter names. Like, I think I do the opposite of what girlfriends do. Girlfriends, like my good friend also, Mike, one of the aforementioned surrogate older brothers who I play basketball with at Williams and also went to law school with. His girlfriend and now wife, who I haven't seen in many years, but I, you know, obviously seeing her a lot when I was younger, Michael. He was always Michael. And I feel like girlfriends always want to do that to distinguish themselves from friends. Oh, your friends call you Mike or they call you H. Well, I'm going to call you Michael because that means we have a more formal and respected relationship than your buddies because I use your full government name. I see that. I think girlfriends tend to do that a lot. Anecdotal evidence, I guess. But for me, it's the opposite. Everybody called him Patrick. And I just always said, what's up, Pat? I never even like thought about it. And then I think at the fifth year, you know, I was like, I keep calling you Pat. It's not that I don't know your name is Patrick, but I noticed everyone calls you Patrick. I don't know why I think that's so funny, but it was just such an oblivious kind of, he never corrected me. He never said, I prefer Patrick. But I was just like, in my head, I was like, everybody else calls you Patrick. Is it just because I'm a giant? And you're like, don't correct the giant. Anyway, I call him or text him and say, hey, you're always up for a beer. You want to go to this show like Tuesday night near my God, I want to remember the name of this bar so badly. But that was what I was saying. Being in DC, I did love that stretch. I was in Cleveland Park, and when you're trying not to be a scumbag, that's probably, I don't know if that's when I started using food to like quell stress or anxiety, but one of my favorite things to do would be go get an individual Chicago classic at Pizzeria Uno right on the corner near where I lived, go to Blockbuster and rent a movie. This is probably not what a virile 23-year-old man should be doing. But it was either that or go get drunk and try to hook up with chicks. And when you're in a relationship, you just sort of say, you know what? I'm going to try not to do that. Oh, it's so the pain I caused in my early 20s, it all feels fun and games now, but it was not fun or funny at the time. That's all I'm saying, folks. But you know what? Sometimes you just... I was going to say something crude there, but the point is I tended to try to gravitate after an overall depressing on every front first semester of my second year, overworked, stressed, guilt ridden, everything was weighing on me. We went to this show. Yeah. But so yeah, on Fridays I would just be like, we're going to make it a Blockbuster night. You 23-year-old who's afraid to go to bars because you'll end up doing things you shouldn't. Isn't that an arrogant thing as I sit here fucking fat as fuck with my hair askew and just dreary looking? Is that like, I think back to those days and I'm like, my goodness, to be in a place where you're like, I can't go out tonight because I know if I get drunk, fucking will occur. Oh shit. God, I am spilling the tea on myself. We had a buddy in law school. I will get to the eventual point of this story, which is somber and sad, but also nice in a weird way. But I had a friend, Dave, who was an absolute pimp in life. And he used to joke with me because there were so many times where I would leave a bar, not so many times, but let's just say more than a handful, where I might as well have just had a show in law school with a devil in like a Georgetown Law t-shirt and an angel in a Georgetown Law t-shirt on my two shoulders. And the good angel won almost every time. But I found myself in many a cab going back to women's apartments and literally going, I'm actually just going to go, like not leaving the cab, but like leaving it till the very last second. This is such terrible behavior in a way, but in the same spot, it's like in hindsight, better to not cheat on your girlfriend and better to not lead on some nice stranger you met at a bar. But man, my friend Dave, I remember him going, he found me not fucking these chicks more reprehensible than if I was just cheating on my girlfriend. Holy shit. A trip down memory lane. So maybe that's why my grades weren't as good as they should have been the first half of my time at Georgetown Law School, because I was busy just dealing with all sorts of moral dilemmas. So anyway, I go to the show. Okay, so now we're back. Enough sidebars. I go to the show with Pat, and I'm figuring, you know what, I'm feeling better. I'm feeling a little better. And, you know, Wednesday night at a bar with Pat near my apartment, that's not going to be some fucking danger zone for JL, jurisdictional pimp. Jurisdoctoral, not jurisdictional, jurisdoctoral pimp. But so I'm watching the show. And I was just like, this is just something to pass time. I don't know if this is going to be good. I've only been to one stand-up show in my life at this point. It was at the DC Improv, funny enough. When I was 20, I went with my brother. We took a trip to DC, sightseeing and all that stuff. Just a fun, you know, fun steakhouse and sightseeing trip with mon frère. And we went to see Bill Bellamy at the DC Improv. And we were guilty of the things that I always complain about now, which was like, hey, my brother definitely got the tickets because he's like, oh, Bill Bellamy, he's like a TV star. He'll be funny. He's in movies and TV. Fun times. And his best bit was definitely about filming Any Given Sunday. It was just more of a story. But we were all wondering who it was, and we were pretty sure it was LL Cool J. He was describing about how like one movie star basically thought he was the shit. And I remember Bill Bellamy breaking it down, being like, there's movie speed, there's NFL practice speed, and there's NFL game speed. And one actor thought he could hang, didn't realize they were going at NFL practice speed, so he was feeling himself and talking some shit. So on the next take, such and such NFL player decided to show him NFL speed. And like apparently just if it was LL Cool J or whoever it was, could it have been Jamie Foxx? I don't know. But whoever he was referring to then got obliterated on like the next take was the point. Very funny story. We were enjoying it. But I remember that show, the feature was a comedian who's still a comedian named T-Rex. And this guy, what a lesson. I didn't know I would be learning a lesson about comedy, because at this point I'm a 20-year-old college student who has no thoughts whatsoever of ever doing stand-up comedy. I just like doing impersonations for my teammates. But T-Rex destroyed. This guy destroyed. My belly was hurting. I was laughing so hard. And some of it was problematic. His funniest bit was about swimming at the Special Olympics. Definitely problematic stuff. But my stomach was hurting. And I felt at the end guilty that I didn't like Bill Bellamy as much, because I was like, oh, my brother bought these tickets to see Bill Bellamy, but like T-Rex was the star of the show for me. But it was a lesson. It was a big lesson that I didn't remember until I became a frustrated feature act. Anyway, so we're at the show at the bar. God damn it, I wish I could remember the name of this bar. And three comics I remember. A guy named Peter Riley, who ended up being like an adjunct professor at Georgetown Law. I had no idea until like my third year of law school when I saw him on the law school campus. I was like, Peter, what are you doing here? And he was like a guy, he had just funny, clean jokes. And if you did a show with him, you'd probably hear 90% of the same jokes. But it was a different, it was like, he was a regular guy. He was just this mild mannered, bald looking guy. He was bald. Mild mannered guy, like khakis and a button down, like, you know, business casual attire. And it was very clean comedy. Like, he was the kind of guy who could definitely do some corporate work and just, but they were funny jokes. And he was just funny. They were like pleasant but funny jokes. Like, what was his one bit? Like, the typical joke would be he just had this, he goes, I just got back from Vegas and I had phenomenal luck. I don't know what it is, but I have great luck. He goes, because I drove out there in a $10,000 Hyundai, but I came back on a $100,000 Greyhound. Like, I know that may be cheesy or dad jokes, but it was really, he was just polished and funny. And for somebody just going to like their second stand-up show ever, I was like, this guy's really good. Then there was a comedian named KT Tatara, who's still a comedian in LA now. Funny guy. And great set. And me and Pat are like, Patrick, are really enjoying the shit out of this show. It was almost like, oh my God, I didn't have to go to a, I went to a free bar show. All I had to do, I got like a beer and we're just sitting here having beers, enjoying this great comedy. It was like, it made it more special because I wasn't a bar. It wasn't like we were at a bar and the show broke out. We went to the bar for the comedy. And it just felt like this like new gem, this new like beautiful experience of like, I can't believe I'm just like a block away from my house. And these funny dudes telling jokes. This is so awesome. And I'm feeling like really like loose and like real stress relief. And maybe that's why, like, when people say to me, especially during COVID, they're like, your videos made my family feel better. Like, this is like the first time I'm connecting this, but I guess in a way I've had that experience like many, many years ago, but like comedy was just like part of the process of me getting out of a funk, in law school. And then Eric Myers was one of the comics on the show. And you got to realize, so Eric Myers at this point, it's February 2003. So he's about to turn, he had, you know, it's not February 29th, obviously, but he's about, this would have been, he's 22, about to turn 23. I'm 23. I'm 24. I'm 23, about to turn 24. So we're in the same age range. And KT was also in that, like, I think he might have been a student at George Mason, if I have but the point is, these guys were like a year or two younger than me, but obviously were funny guys who had already been doing comedy like since college. So they were like, I think probably like 3-year vets, if you want to call it that, but already had their persona and like some really good jokes. And Eric Myers was an absolute killer. And a lot of people have been writing this about him, but he really was. Like, he was a guy who could have relied on just his kind of goofy look. He screeched up his voice. When I go into a Popeyes, I say, give me a me. Like, he talked about having a bird chest. And he, like, one of the jokes along that would be like, when I go into a chicken restaurant, I say, give me the me. Like, whatever it was. But he had the funny jokes with the funny look and the funny screechy like voice. But he didn't rely on the voice or the look. They packaged together, but his jokes were awesome. He had one of his big bits I remember was about the Karate Kid. And he was like, his big thing was like, you ever watch movies when you're older and you're like, what the fuck was that about? Like the Karate Kid. They were competing for the All Valley Karate Championship. And then he would do this like pause and look around, like this darting weird look around and go, who the fuck cares? It was just this bit about the whole motivation of the, and it's a bit that would age beautifully with Cobra Kai, which is sort of poking fun at the Karate Kid. A little self-mockery. But the whole joke was just about like, who gives a shit? Like, the punchline was always like them running Daniel-san off the road, like nearly killing him for like Blockbuster gift certificates. The aforementioned Blockbuster, you know, that was still a thing. There was a Blockbuster right near the bar. But he was so funny, and he was one of those comedians that like Patrick would comment on like from time to time. And it was like, if I was doing a show in DC, like in my third year, I was doing a lot of shows in DC because I started that summer. Part of the reason I started was the encouragement from my friends the summer before, but it was really seeing, I'm not giving all the credit to Eric, but a lot of the credit belongs to him and KT and Peter. But if I'm saying who I thought killed the hardest on that show, it was Eric Myers. And seeing regular people, it wasn't that, oh God, I'm a regular person. I'm funny. I could do that too. But it was seeing, you want to talk about, we'll bring this full circle, representation matters. For me, this wasn't a racial representation. This was, I'm watching regular people in a bar be funny for strangers. When you're at a comedy club, it's sort of elevated. You're like, oh, well, that's amazing, but I could never do that. It's the difference between seeing a guy dunk at Madison Square Garden and seeing a guy dunk at your local park. One, you go, well, that's NBA. That's amazing. But when the guy does it at your park, you go, ooh, maybe that means I could do it. Doesn't diminish the guy doing it, but it makes it more relatable. It makes it a little more approachable. So seeing these guys crush was like the final move that made me say, okay, when second year law school's done, I'm going to try stand-up. Because I know I'm funny, but seeing these guys do it so well made me think I should try it. It didn't make me think I'm better than these guys. I was in awe of everybody on that. Of the three people I mentioned, I was like, oh my God, you guys are so good. That was awesome. But it made me think I could try it. It didn't make me think I'd be good at it, but it made me think I could try it. And Eric Myers is one of those guys. He moved out to LA, and he was like a paid regular at the Comedy Store, which unfortunately in comedy, that in and of itself is an accomplishment. It doesn't mean you have enough money for your life, but those are like competitive hallmarks in your career. And he was a paid like professional at one of the most storied comedy clubs in the world. And he was that good. But it's one of those things that makes me think, and I was listening to a bonus episode of the podcast Tuesdays with Stories, and Mark Normand, one of the two comics on that show, had said they didn't know about him. Joe List, the other host, had actually worked with him and said the guy was a fucking killer. Like he said, I was opening for Nick DiPaolo many, many years ago in Florida, and Eric Myers was the MC, and he was crushing out of the MC spot. And I think for a non-comedian, you may not know what that means, but the MC is there to basically get you in your fucking seat, get you in a laughing mood, and just get you focused. But if a guy is murdering, not murdering because the crowd's stupid and he's doing hacky shit, I've had that happen to me. Twice in my career, I've had hacks crush before me, and I was still finding my footing as a feature. And like, I would go to a place with 30 minutes, and that was the 30 minutes they were getting. Now I come to a place with 6 or 7 hours and can tailor my set if I see a crowd is stupid or this demographic or that. But crushing out of the MC spot with real good shit is it's a bigger accomplishment and a bigger kind of badge of honor than maybe the regular non-comedian could appreciate. But Mark Normand said, you know, you see everybody praising the guy, you watch his clips, he's a killer. And Normand, who's had a very charmed career, he's a super funny guy, but a very good, successful career. But he said, what the fuck are you doing, industry? And I thought about that. I was like, yeah, it's depressing. And the biggest depressing thing about this is Eric was out on the road doing his thing. I believe he was headlining some shows. He had a bunch of gigs lined up at sort of the second tier comedy clubs, the ones in the South that are open. And I mean, second tier as in that's what he was worth. I'm saying he was doing like some of the, you know, the rooms that were available. And, you know, he had a bunch of gigs lined up, and he's a paid regular, and he's a respected, nice guy who had some demons, but a respected comedian. There's nobody out there who's like overrated. No, he really was like funny. And he combined that, I'll give you good jokes and I'll package them in something that like dumb people could laugh at him because he would give them a funny look and a funny voice. But real comedians and real comedy fans could also laugh because there was great material too, funny material. He was the total package. And But when Norman said that, I thought to myself, right, like that's depressing to be like, what more would this guy have had to do to get to that next level? You know what I mean? Like, okay, so maybe he didn't have the social media following, but I will say that I've say this all the time. We have to do better. And I know this is a little bit self-serving on my part, but we have to do better by our comedy talent. If you want diversity, then go get diversity, but get it by going to the comedy club, seeing the real work put in, not the 10-minute clip from some 27-year-old guy with a good headshot who meets the criteria. You can do the comedy skills have become such a, instead of the substance, they've become the side dish. You know, your social media following or your demographic becomes more important than the meat and potatoes, which is, are you funny? Are you really funny? Are you bringing something fresh? Are you do you bring an audience because they love your comedy, or are you bringing an audience because they like you on an app? And I've traveled enough, I've met enough, seen enough comedians in cities big and small that inclusion doesn't have to sacrifice talent, but it does a lot of times, because it's the quicker way. It's the easier way to check your boxes, is to just go, bah, 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 bah. Okay, we got our people. Let's boost these people. Let's boost it. This person is this right type of person. Let's boost her. Let's boost him. And my point is, there's a cynical faction out there who say they only got it because they're this. And they might say that about anybody if they were a woman or a person of color or gay. They might say that regardless. What I'm telling you is that I think, and I know it as much as I can know it, which is not with 100% certainty, but I've seen enough out there that there are people who will sell tickets. There are people with great talent of every orientation, gender, and race. But that the industry a lot of times, they go a lazier route. And sometimes it works out. Sometimes, hey, look at that, two birds with one stone. But I feel like a lot of time they're going demo or social media platform first. Talent is like, oh, good. And they're really funny. They're actually very talented. Instead of going, oh, man, this guy said, we got to find a place for this guy. He's so talented. If you're lazy and you're stupid, you'll worry about, oh, we only had nine. We need more women and we need more people of color because we have nine white guys. Those nine white guys might be really funny. But if you don't get out there and do hard work and like in sports, scouts for college or pro teams, they don't just watch a 5-minute highlight reel or check how many Instagram followers. They go to games. They find out about you as a person. They go watch games. They'll go visit you. They'll watch you against different opponents because they want to see how you match up, how you do this, how you do that. If you did that with comedy, if you worked comedy the way sports scouts work their craft, I think you'd still end up with a rich diversity of talent, but you'd have the talent would be guaranteed. You wouldn't be trying to finagle and massage and engineer and brand manage people who don't have the chops because they meet other criteria. You would have the talent. You wouldn't have to worry about the talent. And you would say, well, look at that. We went out and we went to clubs across the country and we watched a lot of different tapes and we ignored social media followings or didn't pay as much attention to it. And we didn't just say, hey, do you have a black guy or do you have a gay woman? We actually went and watched the sets and we watched them progress and develop. I think you'd end up with diversity as well. It would just be a harder, it would take more sweat equity to get there, but you'd have unassailable results. This is my theory. I have some facts and some opinions and they combine to form my theory, but I can't say this with 100% certainty, but I can say it with more than 50-50 certainty based on me being out there and working with lots of different people and seeing lots of different people. So that's my two cents. And the reason I bring that up is that Eric Myers was a clear talent and he had put in the time and he had gotten, and you know, maybe it was still on the way, or maybe he was doing better than I thought, but he was not, there's a lot of household names. You see a guy like him and you go, this guy could have made dummies laugh and he could have made real smart comedy fans laugh. What else is there? Like, what else could you need from a comedian to make him a household name than that? And, you know, when you factor in that his father had just passed away and that now he's gone at the age of 40, right fucking a week before his 41st birthday, it's like there are bigger things to worry about than his comedy career. But it's like that was his gift. That's what he worked at and that's what he brought into the world. And he was not given his due. Because what I'm telling you is, before I even thought about being a comedian, he was killing and he was making me think about being a comedian. And that was fucking 18 years ago, February 23rd, 2003. He was so good, he made me think about being a comedian. So when you look at that and you say, and he still didn't get his, at least, and I can't say whether he was happy or felt his career was in the right direction. I don't know any of that. So I don't want to speak for him and make it sound like he was depressed. I'm saying as a fan of comedy, I look at a guy like that who's respected and crushing for fucking almost two decades, but still young enough that he's not an old man. And he didn't get his. He didn't get what I think he should have gotten and what I think a lot of comedians would say. And that's, you know, if there's anything that could depress me more than my own career, sputtering or stalling or not finding a path or not getting management, it's that this guy was crushing longer than me, arguably harder than me. I mean, I've had my sets and I've had my great bits, but this guy was a killer. He was respected. He was a nice guy. And now he has passed away tragically without achieving clearly what I think any comedian who knew him would say, yeah, there's no reason for him to not have achieved this. And I think it just speaks to, once again, to tie it into the Golden Globes. I wouldn't say he was a victim, and I don't know this. I think he might have been a victim of just stupidity and laziness in the industry, not because he was a quote-unquote white guy. I'm doing a reversal of my Golden Globes argument. He might have just been because the industry is stupid, and that's tragic enough. That's tragic enough that a talent didn't have that Netflix special or that HBO special. And then it's hard not to project that onto your own life as a comedian who feels some of those. I feel those frustrations for him, but some of that is definitely projection by me. So this was a very long episode. We went a lot of different places, but I hope you enjoyed it. I got to get back to the day job now, but I appreciate you listening. Not as many laughs, I guess, on this episode, but there was a lot of serious things throughout that I hit on. And please, as a reminder, hit up Podomatic and let me know what you think. It shouldn't be too hard for you to navigate. You know, the link is on my website. Just go to jlcomedy.com, click on podcast tab, click on the Podomatic picture underneath the Righteous PK logo, and that'll take you to this page. Find the episode. What should we name this episode? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I'm going to name it. But it'll be the most recent episode, folks. Okay. And you'll know the title by the time you hear it, whether you're listening on Spotify or Apple. But thank you for listening. I hope it wasn't too draining to listen to, but I think there was some solid productivity out of this episode, which isn't that what you always want out of a podcast? Productivity. So have a good week, everybody. Stay safe. I hope those of you that can get vaccines or are eligible for vaccines can get them quickly and soon. Let's get, hopefully we can get back to some kind of normal. I guess that's all I have to say. So have a great week, stay safe, and I will see you next Tuesday.